Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikulskas, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
My guest is Linda Fairstein, who's out with now the 20th novel in her Alexander Cooper series. This one's called Blood Oath. It's available now wherever your fine books are sold. Linda, Alex took a year off there. She was recovering from some things. She came back, and there's really no rest for the weary. She's got colleagues revealing things to her. She's got a new case brought about by the Me Too movement and an empowered young witness. Can you kind of set this up for us? Because I don't want to give anything away.
Sure. Well, as you say, Brian, Alex was away. She had a bad experience, so took a leave of absence, and she is back in full force. She's strong. She's ready to come back. We have an opening scene in the courthouse, and to me it just seemed inevitable to want to do something that reflected what's happened in the last 2 years with what's called the Me Too movement. So the whole cold case idea, which my former colleagues in the Manhattan DA's office are doing so much work with. So we have a young woman, 24, who comes forward now for the first time to report something that happened to her more than 10 years ago, involves a man who has, in the interim, become a very powerful figure. Alex Cooper knows him, and that's all in the first two chapters, and we take off from there.
You know, as I read, and, you know, your young witness who brings up something that happened 10 years ago, there's an Iowa connection there that, of course, I peek every time I read something about Iowa City comes up. Can you kind of explain how that came to be? Because you do use an actual location in Iowa City.
Yes, I use an actual park. Part of the story that I tell, part of this young woman's story, is drawn from, and I often do this, I remember in books, I don't use actual cases, but I draw from motives and ideas. So Lucy, the young woman in this case, grew up outside the city of Chicago, but went with a friend to Iowa. She's a child of a single mother. Her mother died. There's been a lot of distress in the family. And there was a shooting in a public park, and two young friends actually were killed in the park, literally because they were with her. So there is an Iowa connection to the case.
This whole idea of the Me Too movement, we've seen it over the last few years, and it's sort of a thing that took off in the media, and it was a hashtag thing, so it took off on social media. But as a prosecutor and as a lawyer, when you look at those things, how do those translate into what needs to be proven at trial or how you would deal with a jury in this day and age?
Ooh, good questions. And I do a little bit of the latter. We have Alex going into the grand jury with Lucy's case. And that's a sampling of what would happen at a trial. So I'll start in backwards order, if I may. Grand jurors or jurors everywhere in this country have been aware through media, social media, about the issues. But a prosecutor still has to prove the same facts. So, of course, someone can come forward and say something terrible happened to me 8-10 years ago. There still has to be proof. And first of all, the proof is the credibility of that witness. It's hard when you go back 5 years, 10 years, 12, both for the witness, what she's experienced emotionally, but for the prosecutor to try and put together anything that might corroborate, help to source, to prove what she's saying. Sometimes that means you come across counter information. You find out that whoever she's naming wasn't in that city or jurisdiction at the time she says he was. So back to the beginning, the interesting thing about Me Too, I think certainly it has caused, the movement has caused many people to come forward who would otherwise have remained silent and tried to deal with the aftermath, often PTSD, of these events by herself, or in many cases, by himself. But when they come forward, and now you have to put it together, it's the prosecutor has to treat it in any other way. So it's, people expect often that you say Me Too, and that's going to get you through the door of a courtroom. It's not. The credibility has to be evaluated in the way that any other case would, often made more difficult because of the long passage of time. And I think one of the things that makes it fun for me to write fiction is to take the real qualities of a prosecutor and what Alex would be going through in a real case. So while the story is fictionalized, the procedural aspects of what police and prosecutors would have to do is very much based on my own real experience.
You're obviously coming at this from a long career in the legal field. For prosecutors who are coming out of law school now and they grew up in the Me Too movement, do you think they can fall into a trap where they just believe everything they hear as opposed to, and you got to know this from being a prosecutor, your witnesses are always not the most reliable?
Such a good question. And long before Me Too, it's one of the most shocking things. I mean, I started, Brian, in 1972, fresh out of law school. And you go to do public service work, you go to a prosecutorial office to do justice and thinking you're helping people. And I will tell you that the first time you sit across a table from someone who looks you in the eye, you're there to help her, and she or he tells a lie. Sometimes it's a little white lie, but it underpins the whole case. Sometimes it's a fabricated story we've all heard of and seen in fiction, on TV, false reports of cases. There is nothing more unsettling. It makes you rethink, why am I here? How do I deal with this? What happens to the next person I meet? Do I believe or not believe? And so it happened to me, as it does to every prosecutor. As I became a supervisor and in charge of that special victims unit, there was always a moment, the first time someone would come to me, occasionally in tears, occasionally shaking and shaken, to say, I don't think this is true. Can you help me? And I would always sit through with the young lawyer and the witness and go through all the steps of how you prove or disprove. And I think nothing eternally has made it harder for legitimate victims of sexual assault than to follow someone who has been less than honest or actually dishonest about an aspect of a case.
From a prosecutor's standpoint, do you have to 100% believe their story in order to take it to a jury, or can you have some doubt just as a human being?
You're full of good ones. So that's a very hard question. I always believed, and I was taught by two just legendary district attorneys, Frank Hogan when I was a kid in the office, and then Robert Morgenthau, that you had to believe it yourself before you could ask a jury. And what you're asking a jury to do is believe beyond a reasonable doubt. So what you try to do in that trial prep period is eliminate every doubt. And sometimes, most of the time, the real story is there and it's true. Sometimes victims will, just to make themselves appear better, not admit drinking or drug use, not admit prior sexual involvement. And so you just nail what doesn't seem right until you have no more doubts. And bring a colleague in. We work really closely with the NYPD in New York. So I'll have the smart detective sit with me and see if he can work out what the doubts are. But I have always felt it's almost like lying to say to a jury, I'm asking you to believe beyond a reasonable doubt what I myself question. So I think it's a moral dilemma. I know it happens differently in every jurisdiction in this country, but that's really what I believe.
I'm chatting with Linda Fairstein about her new book, Blood Oath. That's the 20th in her Alexandra Cooper series, part of the Manhattan Sex Crimes Unit. She's an assistant district attorney there. Linda, something came up in the news a month or two ago, and I immediately thought of you when it happened, when Alex Trebek announced that he has cancer, and he's fighting a very serious form of cancer. One of the Easter eggs in your books is always this whole idea of betting on the Final Jeopardy category. And so for some reason, when I saw that announcement, I immediately thought of your books. What was your thought as you heard Alex's announcement? And I know how special that show is to you.
Yes, well, thank you. It was striking because although I've never met Alex Trebek, I've never been on Jeopardy, from the first book titled Final Jeopardy, in part because of that show, and then the double entendre for mystery, I feel so very connected to it. And my readers do as well. And I get a ton of mail and questions about Final Jeopardy and what is my connection, and do I know if Alex Trebek has ever read the book. So the night that I saw the TV news and then heard his voice very graciously talking about fighting it, I really felt that a dear friend had been stricken. And so it's an emotional connection, and I admire what he's done and done so well all these years. And I love being able to use his real name and connect to so many readers. The first time, Brian, that I put this leitmotif in the book of the characters betting on Jeopardy, it was to show how smart the characters are without saying. You know, in books, tell us, show us. So Mike's got an expertise in military history, one detective. Mercer has the other detective in world geography, and Coop is an English lit major. So it was a way of showing the reader what their strengths were. And I did it through Alex Trebek and his show. So I do feel very connected, and of course I am pulling and praying for him, as I think everybody who reads my books has communicated they're doing too.
You know, in one of the opening scenes in the book, there's a conversation between Alex and a judge who sits on the bench there. And I thought about that situation, and there wasn't anything, after the judge revealed something important to her, there wasn't anything stopping her from just going out and really embarrassing the judge. What's that relationship like between judges who you appear of in front of every day on a professional level, and then the personal connection that can come when they reveal something like that to you?
It's complicated, and I think anybody you talk to, prosecutor or defense attorney in any jurisdiction who practices, any lawyer really, goes through the same thing. I mean, a lot of the judges, it's a finite world, so you're appearing over and over again in front of the same judges. They spend time with you. You can have a lengthy case of 3 months where you are morning, noon, and often into the evenings in the same physical space with them. You go into the robing room, you and your adversary, and chat about things. It becomes personal. Many, many of the lawyers, rather the judges, are former prosecutors, former defense attorneys. So some you know for a long time in a number of ways. Not this case, it's more professional only that has segued a little into the personal, and that's inevitable. Alex has come back from this bad thing, so the judge takes her inside to kind of see how she's doing, and in the meantime, he's trying to explain to her, he's trying to cut her off at the pass and tell her she's going to hear things about him that shouldn't be believed. So it's not, I know it happens in many jurisdictions and more in federal court that a lawyer will fly in from L.A. to try a case in Sioux City, or fly in from Sioux City to try one in Dallas. But usually in our courts in New York, when it's the state, the local court, you know all of the players, and you hear rumors. So Alex really had to take what he said seriously and try and figure out whether there's a crime at the basis of it.
I've read all of the Alex Cooper books from the beginning, and you know the reader in me hasn't noticed a huge quality difference between them. It's not like they get, they've all been excellent. I mean, I couldn't tell you that the last one is better than the first one, but I know when you first started writing this, you were working full-time as a prosecutor. Do you find that it's easier, or the quality of writing that to you is better when you have more time to do it as opposed to when you're trying to do it with a full-time job on the side?
Brian, that may be the kindest thing anybody said about the writing, and I do notice a quality. I think that Final Jeopardy, my first book, I took my time, even though I was working as a full-time prosecutor, and I wanted to be in this world for so long to write books that I really devoted care and time to writing it, editing as I went along, re-editing. I think my second book, Likely to Die, is sort of the weakest. I rushed it out, and I sometimes wish I could go back and rewrite it. Then I was given the luxury of time by my publishers I wasn't quite doing one a year while I was working full-time, and so I think that helped because I do care about the quality, but far and away, I think Blood Oath is my strongest book. It took longer. I had some readers who would say, because of the 2 years of PTSD Alex had after her traumatic event in Devil's Bridge, I had readers saying, come on, this is not the Alex we know. She's whining. Get her back on her feet. And I really feel she's back with strength in this book, in the courtroom, taking on difficult situations with Lucy and the case. And I'm very grateful for your words. I do think this Blood Oath is the strongest writing in the series, and I think also true of the storytelling.
All right. As she says, the book is Blood Oath. It's by Linda Fairstein. It's available now wherever fine books are sold. And if you've never picked up an Alexander Cooper book, you don't need to start with the first one, but you're really doing yourself a disservice if you don't go back and read them, because they are fantastic. Linda, just a fantastic book here. Thanks for joining us to talk about it.
Thank you, Brian, for the really great conversation. I'm very grateful to you.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakulskas. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.